Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we continue our exploration of consciousness. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the wonderful phenomenon of internet synchronicity. When you're doing some research and you keep coming around one site or one idea or one person, and then you find it some other way in this like vast network of resonating data, which can take on a kind of synchronistic, magical feeling sometimes. And that really came true for me about a year ago or so. I was researching abramelin, a rather esoteric incense used in the Western occult tradition, and I found this fascinating document with lots of data on different recipes and history of the substance. And it was on this site called Lucky Mojo, and it was kind of this overwhelming site that had all these herbs, and I didn't really pay attention to it at the time because I was just looking for this information, and I went, wow, well, there's a lot of information on that site, so I got to go back there. And then a couple months later, I was researching. I think I was reading up on Skip James, who's perhaps my favorite, old school acoustic acoustic blues performer, and I was like doing research on some of his lyrics, and I found another page on Lucky Mojo that was this immense and wonderful collection of all the blues lyrics that contain references to African American folkloric and healing practices. System that I've come to learn is called hoodoo. And so that was pretty interesting. And then a few months after that, I was reading Mitch Horowitz's book, The Occult in America. We've had Mitch on the show, and it's a great book overall. Highly encourage you to read it. But the chapter that I learned the most from was the chapter on hoodoo, which I knew very little about. And he once again, I was drawn back into the Lucky Mojo website. And if you're listening to this in front of a computer, I encourage you to go to the site, not just to get a sense of all the information that's on it, but also the design of many of the products, unguents, herbs, dream books, et cetera, that are sold on this remarkable collection that has really become sort of without doubt the central source for information and products about this very interesting sort of fairly unknown tradition, hoodoo, which we'll be talking more about this hour. So I'm very glad to welcome Catherine Ironwood, the proprietor and powerhouse behind the whole Lucky Mojo operation, onto Expanding Mind. How you doing, Catherine?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for that interesting introduction.
Yeah, well, thank you for joining us. You know, I usually start out asking people about their background and how they got into what they're on about. But before I begin, I know you have a lot of fascinating stories. But before I do that, I would just like you to give a little definition of what hoodoo is, because as I said, I think people, even people who are interested in healing practices and American religion and folk traditions, often don't know very much about it. So it'd be great if you could just give us a sense of what it is we're talking about.
Sure. Hoodoo is just one word of a number of words used to describe African American folk magic, and those words are somewhat regional in their distribution, or were until the globalization of the internet. Back east in the Virginia area, for instance, people who were enslaved populations tended to adopt the language of their slave masters, and they called it witchcraft. But it is different than English folk magic witchcraft. In other parts of the eastern South, it was called conjure, from conjuration. And again, an English word. In some places in the Mid-South, it was called root work because the major thing that distinguishes this kind of work from white Appalachian folk magic is that British and Germanic people tend to use green herbs, dried green herbs, in their magic, which could be called herb magic or yarb magic or herb doctoring, and combines medical and magical things, whereas African people tended to use roots, and so they called it root work. And then in Mississippi and in a few other places in the Mid-South like that, Tennessee, Kentucky, it's sometimes called hoodoo. And hoodoo, generally, when I was young, was sort of an all-purpose word. But I have found that regionally, in North Carolina, for instance, hoodoo means cursing or bad luck. And there's a reason that I adopted the use of the word hoodoo rather than conjure or witchcraft or root work to describe this, and why that word is now popular. And that is, when I started writing about it on the Internet, I wanted to test out search engines, and the only search engine at the time was Alta Vista that was any good. And so I typed in the word hoodoo, and there were no page results. So I put it on the page and saw how long it would take before Alta Vista picked it up, which was 4 months. And I began using the term hoodoo on every page that I mentioned it to check my progress against the search engines. And now people think of it as like it's called hoodoo everywhere, but really it's not. But what we're talking about after that explanation, because I know that some people will listen and say, we didn't call it hoodoo where I grew up. Yeah, you may have called it something else, but it is folk magic that is derived in large part from African traditions. This includes Central Bantu language-speaking Africans, also West Africans of the Yoruban and Fon language groups, and also includes a lot of Native American inclusions, because when the slaves came to the U.S., they could not bring their herbs or roots with them, and those were tropical herbs anyway and roots, and so they could not be grown in America even if they had been able to send for them. So they had to make substitutions, which were mostly based on dealing with the local Native population, who told them, well, we use this herb for that or this herb. And the largest Indian tribe in that southeastern area of the United States was the Cherokee tribe before the removal of the Trail of Tears. And so what we see is a mixture of folk magic from Africa with admixtures of Native American, particularly Cherokee, but other tribes too, Choctaw and stuff like that. And the British slave owners and their Irish bond servants also had folk magic, so that's been mixed in too. And then also there's a small but very definitely prominent a bit of Jewish folk magic mixed in, because later, after emancipation, the pharmacies that sold the roots and herbs were mostly owned by Jewish proprietors who would recommend Jewish folk magic to their customers. And so this tossed salad is called hoodoo or conjure or root work or witchcraft. And it's
I think just to give people a little bit of context, probably some folks have heard of, you know, the idea that there was a lot of voodoo in New Orleans in the late 19th century, and some people know the famous name of Maria Lovo, sort of this like folk character that you discover even as a tourist visiting New Orleans. But after talking to you, I realized that really it really wasn't voodoo that people were talking about in terms of New Orleans. It was really this hoodoo tradition you're talking about, and there's a really important distinction between the two that I think sometimes gets lost.
Yeah, unfortunately, the two words rhyme, but there's a lot of words that rhyme, and if people would just get over that, they'd be a lot smarter, you can't substitute any word that rhymes for any other word. Voodoo is a religion. It is the state religion of the nation of Benin, and slaves who were snatched from that area kept that religion in the Spanish language slave colonies. Just to make it real long story short, different enslaved populations were treated to different rules. The French, the Spanish, and the English had different rules. In the Spanish populations, people kept their traditions. And so in Cuba, we see voodoo. We also see what's sometimes called Lukumi or Santeria. And we also see what's called Pala, which is the Congo religion. They remain. In Haitian, island of Haiti, we see mostly voodoo because that was the dominant population that was enslaved. And the French also had very liberal laws as far as teaching the slaves religion. They were made to convert to Catholicism, but they were allowed days off where they were allowed to do whatever they wanted to do. And they eventually, of course, used those days off to plot and plan a slave revolt. The only successful slave revolt in the New World was in Haiti. And that was mostly carried out by people who were priests of voodoo. In the U.S. and in Jamaica and in other British-ruled countries, there were not these large populations kept on plantations in the way they were in the French and Spanish slave colonies. Although we think of the plantations of the South, most slaves were in much smaller groups on small, you know, farms and plantations and also in the cities. And they were converted to Christianity, and they were actually, although we know how horrible slavery was, there was kind of a more of a mingling in some ways of the language and of the culture. And so, and particularly because of the long fight for abolition, there were religious groups like the Quakers and Baptists who did a lot of work trying to free slaves, and they came into, you know, strong contact with black people. And so there was a kind of a mixture. Also, the entire native populations of places like Haiti, you know, Tobago, Trinidad, Jamaica, were heavily decimated compared to the Cherokee Nation in the U.S. So there was all this admixture of Native American stuff that kind of continued. So what we had was a very different thing. If you trace the stuff back to Africa, you'll find that Jamaican folk magic, Obeah, or Obi, some people call it, is more similar to hoodoo than either are to voodoo because of the population of Africans that started it. There's a lot of interesting things that could be said about it, but let's talk about what it's like now. Of course, you know, hundreds of years on, it has become thoroughly Americanized. And again, Jamaican culture is more like American culture than, say, Haitian culture is because of the English influence on both of us and the Jamaicans. And so what we see really is a kind of a folk magic that we share with the Jamaican black population and our American mixed race and black population. And I have to say here, too, that although hoodoo and conjure and root work are very much carried by the culture bearers who are African American, it is not ever been exclusively practiced only by black people.
Well, that's one of the things that seems really fascinating about it is precisely its role, or its salad, as you call it, its mixture. That there's a lot of shape shifting almost inside of it, and it's something that all of these folk practices get kind of drawn together because there's something about the basic needs that people have that create commonality, and also there's these sort of inherited practices of hand that come down through the sort of margins of a culture rather than the mainstream theological traditions or church services that invariably kind of are open to one another. And that seems to be one of the things. I mean, was that indeed part of how you found your own way into it, which is that it wasn't just like studying some external other people's tradition. It was something that fascinated you, and you could find your own way into it, even with your own, you know, Northern California Jewish background.
Well, I, as you mentioned in your introduction, I like old blues music. I'm 63 years old. I was part of that folk music revival thing, but prior to that, of course, I was very interested in rock and roll and jump blues. And I grew up in the East Bay, and there were three radio stations. One was KEWB, and one was KYA, and the other was KDIA that played rock and roll music. And KYA played only rock and roll music by white people, only. They played no black people's music, as far as I could tell. KEWB played a mixed bag, and KDIA, which was the largest black-owned radio station, known as for its famous jingle, KDIA, Lucky 13, they played mostly black music, although they did play Elvis Presley and things like that, too. So I was a kid, and I was listening to this stuff, and I wanted to buy some records, and I'd go down to the local record store, which was Palmer's Drugstore at that corner of University and Shattuck in Berkeley, and I'd buy my records. And one day I wanted a record, and it was on the Excello label, and which was out of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And the man very kindly said, "We don't carry that kind of a record. You have to go to Oakland." And I said, which was heavily black and still is. And I said, well, I knew what bus to take. I said, "Where do I go?" And he told me what record store to go to. So I took the bus to Oakland, and I bought my record. And I was thinking about this. I realized I could take walk home. It would not it wouldn't be that long of a walk. So I walked home, and I thought next Saturday, I had enough money to buy one record every Saturday. Next Saturday, I thought I'll just walk to Oakland, and then I'll walk home, and I'll have saved some money for the bus. You know, I'll be able to buy more records. And so on the way home, I saw this store, and it said candles, and then there's a little sort of a decoration of a leaf, and then it said underneath that, spiritual supplies. And I thought, how can a candle be a spiritual supply? I had no idea. So I walked in, and when I walked in, I all of a sudden realized that I was in a room of very curious black people all turning and looking at me. And I thought, uh-oh, I hope I don't get in trouble. And my parents were, Jewish, Sicilian, communist anarchists and members of the civil rights movement, and I wasn't afraid. I just was like, uh-oh, now I'm in a place I don't know what I'm supposed to do. So I just, did what a polite person did. I said, what do you sell here? And the man was very nice. He said, we sell supplies. And I said, okay, that's good. You sell supplies. So I said, do you mind if I look around? He said, no, go right ahead. And I looked, and there was a thing on the shelf that said, Essence of Bend Over Floor Wash. And I almost burst out laughing, but I was a good student even as a teenager. I looked at that and I said, I don't understand it. What is Essence of Bend Over Floor Wash? And he was standing right there, and I said, damn, I held it up and I said, what's this? And he said, that's Essence of Bend Over Floor Wash. I said, well, what do you use it for? And he just gave me this look, and he said, some of the people work for other people. And I thought, he means domestics who wash the floors of white people might want this floor wash to get favors from their bosses. It was just, I was 14, but I understood that. And I said, oh, can I buy this? Because I thought, well, this will be something very interesting to have. And he said, he looked at me and he goes, you're a young girl. You don't wash floors for nobody. And I said, well, that's true. He said, you want magnetic sand. And I said, I do. Okay. So he showed me how to use magnetic sand. He sold me a little package of magnetic sand, which is steel filings. And he said, sprinkle it under a little boy's feet, and where he'll step in it, he'll step backwards and step in it, and ask him, when you do that, you just ask that he will ask you out to a dance. And he will. So I decided to test it out. I took this magnetic sand. I went to Garfield Junior High, now Martin Luther King Junior Middle School. And I went to school, and there was this boy, and his name was Jamie Morrison. And I hope he's still alive, and I hope he hears this. And Jamie Morrison was the most popular boy in school. And I sprinkled magnetic sand at his feet, and he stepped in it, and he asked me to go to the prom. So I was hooked.
I love that. That's a wonderful story.
I have to explain here. I was the little, Jewish art geek. That's what I was, a little Jewish art geek. This guy was never going to invite me to the prom. There was a hook. He wanted me to do the posters, and he said if I did the posters, he'd take me to the dance. And he had just had a quarrel with his beautiful girlfriend Betsy Mueller, the most popular girl in school. But he did. He was very polite. I did all the posters. He took me to the dance. He danced one dance with me. Meanwhile, he'd made up with Betsy. He kissed her, and he didn't. He didn't take me home. He just said, will you be okay getting home? And I said, yeah, I will. But I did get invited to the dance, the only dance I ever got invited to the entire time I went to school.
It still definitely counts as a win.
It was a win. So I was
You know, and I know, as I said, I know you have a lot of stories in there. There's one also I definitely want to get to. Clearly you are a scholar and a lover of this material, and you've managed to collect an enormous amount of fascinating books and objects and lore and recipes and stuff. And I know that you were, an early and heavy user of the internet, and you were putting a lot of this information online because it wasn't there, and it was a great place, a great repository for all of this lore that you were collecting. But then somewhere along the way, you became not just a sort of student and chronicler and lore collector, but also a proprietor, and in some sense, a carrier, a more direct carrier of this knowledge through your shop. Could you talk about that and how that developed?
Sure. Yeah. It was completely by accident. I've been a professional writer all my life, and I'm an astrologer. I used to write astrology columns for the underground papers in San Francisco. I'm just what I am. Worked in the comic book business for 26 years. All types of things. And what I was working on a book. I've collected Lucky Charms. I'm one of these, I'm just one of that type of people that that type of people. I got all the stuff. I collect stuff. So I've been collecting Lucky Charms since I was 12. And so I decided when Apple had invented this a program called HyperCard, and you could, it was like a forerunner to hypertext markup language. So you could, relate one thing to another. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool to make a book that had all my Lucky Charms, and I mean I have thousands and thousands of them, from all around the world, all eras going back to ancient Egypt, little dime store trinkets, rare folkloric items. And I was going to take a photograph of each one. I'm kind of hard of seeing. I'm kind of like what you might call legally blind. But scanners had just been invented, and I found I cannot take a picture, but now I can, of course, with digital cameras. They have not been invented. But I found that I could put something on a scanner, and I could put it in Photoshop and clean it up. So I started taking these scanned pictures of flat objects in my collection, and then I'd write up a little write-up about them. And I put them into this HyperCard program, and then I got this idea when HyperText markup language was shown to me by my friend Fred Burke. He said, you can learn this. It's even better. And I was like, wow, this is cool. So I got a website, and this is in the early 90s. I got a website through a university. And they just gave me a page, So then I began putting all these things together, and I was going to sell this project to some place like, Chronicle Books, and it was going to be a book on Lucky Charms, and there was going to be a disc in the back, in a pocket. I had this whole idea of a library pocket with a disc, and you could put the disc in, and all the pictures would be there, and it would be cheaper than printing the book in color. And I was like, this is going to really work, And it would all be linking, and it was just this idea. Well, to test it, I put it on the web, which nobody had the web at that time, except for governments and universities. You were writing about that stuff back then, and you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
I got this phone call, and this gal calls me up, and she's working for the government, for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and she's an African-American woman. She's a manager. She's very educated, and she says to me, I saw you put this, you have John the Conqueror root, which was, I had put it up as a charm, Lucky Charm, carry it in your pocket, Lucky Charm for gambling and for sex, and that's all I had written about it, and she says, can you get me one? And I said, I'll send you one. So I mailed her one, and just free, just because, my gosh, the web is so small, and there's all these strange people on it, and it was just so cool. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. Someone read my web page. Wow, And I mailed her one, and she calls back, and she says, can you get me another 10 of them? And I said, well, you could go down to the Clover Hornets down in Washington, D.C., where you live. And she goes, well, that's a bad part of town. I don't go down there no more. And I said, well, really? I can go down to Oakland and get you some. I'm up here in Sonoma County. I said, I'll go down to Oakland. I went down to the Egypt Candle Shop, and then that's when I noticed that Bishop White, who ran the Egypt Candle Shop, was very ill. And I thought, uh-oh, it looks like we're going to lose the Egypt Candle Shop within 2 years. And I just had this feeling, this is not going to stand. And I hadn't, thought of myself as a culture bearer or carrier. I just was, someone who knew this stuff, used the stuff, worked with the stuff, and was a professional writer and artist. And I thought, uh-oh. So I bought the roots, and I sent them to this gal, and I sold them to her. And I thought, I actually bought out every root that they had at the Egypt Candle Shop, and I put them online, and I said, if you want to buy these, you can send me money. No PayPal, nothing like that existed. And people began sending me money. And I was like, far out, And then Bishop White passed. And then I was like, now it's going to happen. Is this going to go away? Will it not make the transition to the 21st century? So I decided to abandon the book on Lucky Charms, which is still online for free for anyone to read. It's called the Lucky W. Amulet Archive, and there's hundreds and hundreds of Lucky Charms on it. It never became a book. And I began to write my memories, and it started off with my memories of the Egypt Candle Shop and other things. And I just began to write more and more and offer things for sale. And it grew into this little mini empire, I guess you could say. And I have a shop. But the shop, I have to explain here, the shop is not run at a profit. It is not legally a non-profit, but it is a non-profit structurally. And I hope by the end of my life to, in fact, sooner than that, I hope within the next 5 years to make it a non-profit. My husband, Nagashiva Ironwood, who you had interviewed once because he was a techno-pagan, I met him through the internet, and he and I have been together for a long time, and he has founded a nonprofit organization called the Ironwood Institution for the Preservation and Public and popularization of indigenous ethnomagicology, which has the initials YIPI. And YIPI exists to harvest our folkloric collection of goods and things, and eventually the Lucky Mojo Curio Company will become the kind of the museum store branch of YIPI when we get this all set up. So the store exists, but it's kind of weird because I price everything just at the break even. We have a dozen people working for us, making and praying over the products. We have a very active group of readers and root workers. And what I found out, and this is something else about politics, and I'm always thinking in those terms too, I have to admit, as well as magic. When this started, there were very few people who I connected with in the black community through the internet because of the cost of computers and the poverty line. I'm sure you can all do the math and figure that one out. And I was very happy by the mid-90s all of a sudden to realize I had met my market and my market had met me. And when I began to get orders from places like Georgia and Louisiana and Mississippi and the Carolinas, and then I realized that the computer had penetrated to all segments of the population. And I was thrilled to find that out because that was really what I was hoping for, you know, is in terms of the development of the internet. What happened as to why I became this expert and why I am this proprietor and all, I love art, I love labels, and I was, you know, interested in preserving this old stuff. When the old stores died out, I just sort of filled the gap. I never thought of myself as this, you know, this Jewish white girl who's going to go up as, you know, an expert on black culture. I just was writing anecdotes and stories, and then I, you know, what I found out was that I sang in a church. I don't know if y'all have ever heard of a guy named Johnny Otis, but he's a
sure
musician, and Johnny had a church, and I was in his choir, and up here in Sonoma County, and Johnny Otis, he just comes out of the jump blues tradition and rock and roll tradition. Well, anyway, and he grew up in Berkeley too. He's you know one of my compatriot kind of guys, I guess. Well, anyway, so I was into singing in his choir, and one of the ladies in the choir said to me, you know, you have these roots. This is when I was just still selling things like for a dollar, send me a dollar in the mail, and I'll send you something. You know, and she said, you know, my grandfather in Tennessee used to do this, but we don't do this anymore. Now, she was about my age. That was at that time in my late 40s. And I said, you know, she says, you know, I was told that I was going to be the first person in my family to go to college, and that I was to leave this stuff behind. And I said, I know what you mean. And I said, you know, I had the luxury of being a, you know, this dropout from an academic Jewish family who was, you know, able to go live in the woods and be a dirt hippie and raise goats. You know, we all, you know, we met each other one, you know, in different paths. And I said, I'm the one who sat down and traveled around the country literally and listened to people like your grandfather in Tennessee, because I would just go and like interview people. And I said, you were in college, you know, and she said, yeah, you know. And so she said to me, what did my grandfather do? And I found myself in this unique position that I was able, I didn't know her grandfather personally, but you know what I mean? I was able to tell what the old grandmothers, our ages of, you know, my grandmother's age, her grandmother's age, what they were able to do.
Well, I want to go into more on this, your role in this, in propagating this marvelous tradition. But we're going to take a break here. This is Eric Davis. You're listening to Expanding Mind. We're talking to Catherine Ironwood of Lucky Mojo fame, and we will be back after these brief messages.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is Dr. Meir Eisenstein. Listen to me every Monday evening at 7 p.m. I'm going to explain to you how less medicine, less pharmaceuticals, less vaccines may actually make you healthier. I will be live. It'll be a call-in every Monday night at 7 p.m. Please come and join me.
So join in on the conversation at 888-874-4888 every Monday at 7 with Dr. Eisenstein.
I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us. Every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m., Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
Everybody, this is Richard Martin of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. I'm on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com twice a week on Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to guide you and hold your hand through the worst economic catastrophe of all time. I predicted this right here on PRN back in 2005, along with the housing meltdown. Listen in and hear how this calamity is about to get much worse, and hear me suggest ways in which you can sidestep a large part of the horror. Call in and have your questions answered in real time. Let's see this thing through together. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com hosts my show Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. EST right here.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis. We're talking to Catherine Ironwood, proprietress of the Lucky Mojo website and store. And again, please check it out if you're sitting in front of a computer or later on listening to this. It's one of my favorite sites online. It's old school in the sense that it provides a tremendous amount of information. It's all too infrequent these days that one discovers much more than chatter or the latest reflections on the latest memes. And it's great to have a repository of a tremendous amount of cultural lore with good aesthetics as well. So, Catherine, I wanted to ask you about when you were going around interviewing folks, you were also, I presume, collecting recipes, getting information, getting the how-to kinds of data that's really, you know, where the practical level where this tradition is really centrally located. What was that process like? Were people resistant or were people friendly in terms of sharing information? How did that go?
Well, in order to understand some of that, I do have to explain that I collect everything. You know what I'm saying? I never thought of myself as going to be the person who is going to, you know, save hoodoo for the internet generation. And in fact, I've received some, criticism that, you know, what am I doing being this culture bearer? All I can say is I filled a gap when it was needed. But at the time, I was collecting all types of folklore. You have to understand, I'm just a collector type of person. So I was traveling around the country, you know, talking to people about had they ever seen a UFO or what was poke root good for, you know, whatever. And whoever I talked to, I talked to. But I did have a fascination with the artwork and the distribution of hoodoo products in urban areas because I understood when I grew up in the East Bay, most of the black community there consisted of people who were my parents' generation who had come up in World War II to work in the shipyards around in Richmond and Mare Island and all in that area. And so they mostly came from the Gulf area because they had some ship experience, right? So they came from Mississippi and Louisiana. And this is pretty well known how the East Bay was settled. Well, when I traveled around, I went to Chicago and, down on Maxwell Street and talking to people, and they did the same thing. And I realized, of course, understanding the history of music, that those people had come up from Mississippi up the Mississippi River and had ended in Chicago. So I began to think, well, this is something from Mississippi only. So when I traveled around back to New York City, then I found out people were doing the same stuff. And so then I thought, well, what is it that, you know, the centrality of this? I began to study it and talk to people. So you asked the question, were they friendly and engaging and open? Some were not. The shop owners often were. Shop owners were often Jewish. They usually had a black shop manager. In some cases, the Jews by then had died off. Their children had not wanted to continue running a ghetto store and had become doctors or pharmacists or something like that. In some cases, the Jewish people had been pharmacists who had run these hoodoo shops, and they did double to both doing you know, over-the-counter pharmacy and running a conjure shop. So there was a kind of a transitional period there in the 70s that I was watching these things evolve and change. And but some stores, the people would literally give me their recipes. Here, take my recipes. I just don't compete with me in my own town. Other places, I'd buy them. I also am a very observant person. I'd ask them for something that they were out of, and if they made them themselves, I'd watch what they put in it. Many people will file their essential oils in alphabetical order. It's just the easiest way to find all your essential oils. If you ask somebody to make something, and they get something from over here, and something from over there, and something from over there, you can pretty much figure out where in the alphabet it is, and with your sense of smell, you can recreate it. Sometimes people would, especially in Oakland, where I was from and where people knew me, they knew me because I'd come in with my little notebook and I'd sit at their feet, literally on the floor, and say, you know, so what do you do for this? And the two old ladies would sit in the chairs, you know, these would be the old retired grandmothers, and they'd sit in the chairs and they'd say, one of them would say, well, you do that, and the other would say, no, tell her to do, you know, you do this, you do that. So, and I'd write them both down.
Well, that's one of the questions I had for you, is that obviously, in any tradition, even very organized, formal traditions that have strict hierarchies of knowledge, there's a lot of variation in terms of practices, but I can only imagine the variations in terms of ingredients and practices is enormous, and in fact, that's part of the appeal of the tradition, is that it's very fecund, and there's a lots of diversity within it. But when you came to creating formulas, you know, for specific purposes for your shop, how did you determine which formulas and where were you going to be creative in your own right? I mean, how do you balance that need for novelty and exploration with the quote-unquote tradition?
Well, I've made a combination. When I started the shop, I decided that 36 products would make a good line, and I picked my 36 favorites, some of which have turned out to be nobody's favorites, and I made a bad mistake. But I'd say I was right on 30 out of those 36 are the favorites. And those were solid recipes I had. I wasn't going to be innovating at all. But I did innovate. In the first 36, I did innovate one recipe, my friend Fred Burke and I decided to make a gay, queer, lesbian, whatever, oil formula for love, and we called it Lavender Love Drops. That was one we and we worked on it ourselves. I mean, you know, that was our formula based on old other things. But we did not innovate that, by the way. I mean, there were other gay love formulas. I just wanted to make my own. And he did, and I wanted to help him. So that's his. But other than that, these were the older formulas. Well, then people would say, well, if you have this, why don't you have that? And I'd say, well, of course, I've got that in my book. And so I had my notebooks. So I'd pull out my notebook, and I'd say, okay, now I made that. Well, I'll make a label for it. And then they want this one. So now it's grown to 350 different formulas. So there is a lot of duplication. In other words, what's the difference between Stay With Me and Stay At Home? They have overlapping ingredients. They have different kind of slightly different intentions. One is Stay With Me means don't divorce me. Stay At Home means don't go out with anybody else or go out bowling, you know, whatever. But their names are very similar. So what I kind of did was just kept on bringing these along, the older recipes that I had. And every once in a while I'd say, well, you know, I can make something here to fill a gap that didn't exist. But mostly, I scored a very large score. A man who had been in this business was retired from the business, and the company that he had worked for no longer made these kind of products. They only make African-American cosmetics now. And he gave me quite a few recipes just out of the goodness of his heart. And he was a very nice a guy. And so I do have recipes still to this day that I have not put into play. you know, different people invented them in different places. And so, like, for instance, this is an example with money. I'd say that a good part of the money recipes have mint in them, and then there's a good part that have no mint in them but have cinnamon in them. And very rarely will you find one that has both mint and cinnamon. It's like almost like two different strains of thinking made these up. And so I don't like mint all that much, so I made the cinnamon-flavored once, and I made some variations that came with that from that family, the cinnamon family of money products. And then people say, well, you don't make such and such. And I'm like, all right, that's one of the mint ones. So I made that, and I made that another. And so now I just have this proliferation of them, and some of them are mint and some of them are cinnamon, you know. They just are what they are, you know. Sometimes they'd be these'd be regional little stores, you know, like in Atlanta. Some guy makes a love drawing oil. It's different than say, the one that you would buy in Chicago from a manufacturer in there. They have overlapping ingredients, some same, some different, you know.
This is wonderful. I'm glad for all the detail also on the kinds of spells worked by these compounds. And one of the things I was talking with Nagasivo when I was visited your store, which is anyone who can should visit. It's a wonderful place. It's very beautifully designed and a very welcoming, fascinating place in Forestville, Sonoma County. But one of the things we're talking about is that even from, you know, there's a lot of people today who they'll call themselves Wiccans or neo-pagans, and meaning that they're interested in magic. They believe that natural objects and things from nature have powers. They're interested in an enchanted and practical kind of spirituality. But there's also a lot of a lot of difference between that kind of approach. You know, people mostly generally white. From the kind of natural magic that's represented in hoodoo. Could you talk a little bit about that? There's something about the pragmatism, just the overt getting stuff you want in the world, that I think a lot of people are also resistant to, even people who are interested in magic and folkloric practices.
Yeah. There's a lot of cultural aspects to this that are important to understand. First of all, just as far as one other thing I did want to add to that previous thing, which is my recipes and what I do. Over the years, the companies that made this stuff, and I got to explain here, a lot of these started off as alcohol-based perfumes and tinctures. When Prohibition came in, people began making oils because they couldn't get an alcohol license. They didn't want to get in trouble. So we use oils, whereas in some of the earlier traditions, you would have seen the word perfume used. It would have been an alcohol-based tincture of the same type of stuff. But anyway, we use oils because since America had Prohibition, it just sort of affected hoodoo forever. And what I was finding was that these old stores were being taken out, and new stores were coming in, and factories were making these products. And the factories were making the products with unsafe chemicals. And I'm going to just mention the name diethyl phthalate. You can look it up online. That was another impetus to my work going back to using regular oil, like almond oil. I chose almond oil as my usual base because it was it's a locally produced product, and I like it. But when I was a kid, people would use literally they would make these things up in anything from peanut oil to Crisco to lard, any kind of an oil-based substance to take up the essence of the plant. And that's where your next question goes, to the essence of the plant. A lot of what we find in hoodoo is based around the idea of plants as allies, plant spirits, and spiritualism, spiritism, and spirituality. But it is pragmatic in that these plants are seen as having a magical focus. In some of the neo-pagan practices, what we see is more of a visualization and attunement with the universe form of magic, which is legitimate, but it's a little different than saying, I'm going to sprinkle hot pepper here, and this guy's going to walk in it, and his feet are going to burn until he leaves town. And that's the magical use of a plant that has a physical component, namely, it will burn you. But it won't burn your feet through your shoes, literally, but it will burn you magically if you pray into it, if you sprinkle it with the right prayers, intention, focus. But you do need that plant to help you along. You couldn't just sprinkle white powder and have him step in it and have it work. although some of these modern companies, these factory companies, were simply literally sending out white powder and calling it hot foot powder instead of making it with the regular ingredients that used to be used in the South and in the West and every all through the black community when I was a kid. So part of it was returning these things to natural ingredients. But then what the kind of magic that we do in hoodoo is practical. Most of it is for love, money, and protection. There is health work, but I think people have a pretty, it's not like a faith healing practice in that, you know, it's going to cure someone's cancer. I think everyone knows that we all die. But there is a lot of healing work that goes on. There is not a lot of, that sort of that image that you get from the, Poverty Row movies, you know, the drums, Buana, the drums, you know, the cursing and that, you know what I'm saying? There's not a lot of that that goes on unless it's justified. I think most people who practice hoodoo are Baptists and, in some cases they might be, Pentecostal, Holiness, church or spiritual church movement, which is the black version of spiritualism. And it's spiritualism. It's just different organizations, they're Metropolitan Spiritual Church and things like that. Well, anyway, those people from all of those churches do practice hoodoo because it's what you do when you need to get something extraordinary done. But it is done with prayer, usually with what is sometimes referred to as Old Testament prayer, meaning Jewish folk magical use of the Psalms and other passages from the Tanakh that are used magically, and Jewish folk magic have entered into hoodoo. Some people will use a New Testament prayer, too, but it's often from the Old Testament. So, you know, you might say the Song of Solomon, for instance, to get a boy to love you. But you'd also be using those herbs. There's herbs mentioned in the Song of Solomon, spikenard and all this other stuff, where you would make up a little compound of it and sprinkle it around where he was. So Jewish folk magic did have herbs in it, and black folk magic certainly does. And so it's a kind of a combination of traditional magical practices, what sometimes is called sympathetic magic. You know, you make a doll baby, you put someone's hair in it, then you affect the doll, then that affects the person. That's sometimes called magic contagion or sympathetic magic. There's also what's called the doctrine of signatures, which is a plant has a certain look. That look reminds you of something else. You use the plant because it looks like that, like a violet leaf looks like a heart. You wear it in your shoe, you'll walk to find a lover. And so we do all of these things with plants, with prayer. We are known for the fact that unlike Wicca and some of these modern religions, most of us are Christian or Jewish or whatever. I mean, we're certainly welcoming to neo-pagans, and I have Hindu students and Muslim students, too. And there's a lot of similarities with Muslim folk magic because, of course, North African Muslim stuff partakes of African ideas, too. But a lot of what we do is what we call justice work, and this would involve, trying to... When people are powerless, you know, they sometimes seek justice by extraordinary means. And so we do a lot of court case work, for instance, a lot of court case work, compared to other forms of magic, because of black experience in America has been unjust primarily. As a system of magic, hoodoo is unique for the amount of court case work that is... known. And this would involve things like what's called chewing the root, is a particular root that you chew in the court and spit and hope the judge or the bailiff will walk in it. There's boiling the beef tongue, put all the witnesses' names, what are called the bad witnesses' names, the policemen who arrested you, all that sort of stuff, in the beef tongue with the red pepper and the other things, and boil the beef tongue. In the old days when I was young, and I mean old days when I was young, not really old days, there was a lady in Oakland who specialized. She would she'd boil the tongue on the day of your court case, and she'd sit down with her little grandson, and they'd eat the tongue and eat all the papers with all the names of the people. They would literally eat the names of the bad witnesses so they could not speak against you. So that kind of work, you don't find that in the world of neo-pagan Wicca, because there just wasn't a need among the more empowered classes for that kind of court case work, where you do see that. But, you know, that is a reflection not so much of necessarily an African tradition, but the African-American tradition of being at odds with the law. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I mean, you had mentioned it earlier also, but I'd love to hear you talk, reflect a little bit more about the Jewish role historically, because it seems to me, I mean, you're interested in this phenomenon on so many different levels, and you're invested in it in so many different levels, and it seems to me that you're kind of simultaneously a scholar, a practitioner, a collector, and in some sense carrying on the tradition of the Jewish shopkeeper who actually provided all this material and had the distribution thing, and it's this wonderful bouquet of positions that you have in relationship to it. But I find that the role of Jews in interacting with African-American culture in this way is really fascinating, because, as you say, it was not just that they were selling him stuff. There was elements of Jewish magic and you know, the fifth and sixth books of Moses, et cetera, tradition at all. So, or sixth and seventh. Could you talk about that a bit?
Sure. One of the things that you know surprised me when I started studying about this. Let me explain this. Let me go back here. On my mother's side of the family, my family is Ashkenazi Jewish from Franconia, Germany, and this is like Nuremberg, you know, Mark Erlbach, Firth, and all these little towns around there. And they were in the hops trade, and they were lawyers and bankers, and they were, you know, the Cohn family and the Erlinger family. All the, you know, so they all came, you know, when the Holocaust happened, they all sort of spread around the country, and they ended up in America, they ended up in England, South America, and my family just has a tendency to kind of, you know, just. I don't know. We're it's genetic. I think we're all kind of collectors and scholars and interested in people and their cultures. And you know, my grandfather was the one who really started me like collecting folklore. He said, you know, watch what your little friends do. That's what he said. You know, he write down your little friends have jump rope rhymes. You should write them down. And I was like, okay, I will. And so you know, for me there was that. But then I realized that strangely, while I was, you know, collecting all this stuff, that I noticed right away, you know, you recognize what's called a Landsman's name. You know what I mean? So when someone has a name that's an Ashkenazi name, like Silverberg, you go, well, this is Mr. Silverberg. He must be, you know, and actually there are Silverbergs in my family. You know, and here's another person, and they've got another, you know, another name that is in my family. You know. And I'm like, that's interesting. And then there were also some Russian Jews, too, like Konofsky. And I'm like, huh, okay. So I noticed those names. And, you know, you just would if you were Jewish, you see. And so I'd ask them, how did you get into this? And I'd find out that a lot of them, what happened, and a lot of them were very frank about this, after World War I, there were really not any pharmacy programs for black people to become pharmacists. And Jewish chemistry and pharmacy was, like, very highly developed. And, of course, there were all these refugees coming over and stuff like that. And the white people would not let the Jews be pharmacists because of this whole European belief that Jews poison people, right? And Jews poison whales. I'm sure you've heard all this anti-Semitic
language.
You know. So they had to become pharmacists in the black part of town because there were no black pharmacists. So this was this kind of weird little amalgamation. So here I am in this shop. Now, this shop, I just, you know, could be any shop, but I'm here, I'm in a shop, and there's a book called Secrets of the Psalms, and I'm looking at that, and I open it up, and the first thing, I mean, I just literally, as a teenager, I open it up, and I see the name Rabbi Luria, and I'm like, what the heck? I'm in a completely black-owned shop with a picture of Martin Luther King, John Kennedy, and Bobby Kennedy on the wall, and I'm reading about Rabbi Luria. And I look around, and I'm like, am I having some kind of a weird time warp here? And I look at what the book is, and it's by a guy named Godfrey Selig. And I'm like, well, Selig, that's a, you know, Jewish name, right? I'm like, what the heck, you know? So I went, and I asked in my family, what is this? My mother was a research librarian. She goes, oh, well, this is, you know, whatever that book is, Tehillim Shemot. This is the Secrets of the Psalms. It's a Hebrew book. I'm like, it's from the 10th century. And I'm like, what? And it turns out it's been translated into German, and then from these German Jewish, it's been translated from Hebrew into German, and then from German into English. And I'm like, whoa, this is so strange. So I was in Mr. Silverberg's shop back east, and I'm like, he has the book, and I'm like, what's with this, you know? And he's like, well, you know, he's a nice guy. And he goes, well, you know, they want something from the Bible, so I just give them the Psalms, you know? So that's how it started. It's very interesting. Now, and I have to say something else, too. It's not just top-down that Jews imposed this. There is cultural appropriation is a charge that we hear. You know, like you go in and you like for instance, these neo pagans, these Wiccans, we're going to worship Hindu gods and we're going to have them be our goddesses. You know, that's cultural appropriation. Black people are as capable and as empowered to engage in cultural appropriation as any other people on earth. And they would say, I'd go into these black shops and they had Buddhas, right? And I'd say, what do you do with that? We rub the Buddha for luck. Well, they weren't really, they were just doing cultural appropriation. So they were taking from the Jews as well as being given by the Jews. It's a two-way street here. And the sixth and seventh books of Moses, these were being sold, and there's another one called the Lost Eighth, Ninth, and Tenth books of Moses, that was really a translation into English of a translation into German and French of a Hebrew book called The Sword of Moses. It was translated by a guy named Moses Gaster in the 1890s. This all of a sudden shows up in these hoodoo shops in the 1930s. And these books stay in print. They sort of become public domain and everybody reprints them. And so all of this stuff is being melded. And, you know, I've been asked, for instance, did black people practice astrology? Because astrology is like the, you know, one of the crown jewels of Western esoteric tradition. Yes, of course they did. Edward Lowe in Chicago sold astrology charts in the 1920s. He was black. He also made Algiers perfume, meaning from Algiers, Louisiana, not Algiers, North Africa. And in other words, across from New Orleans. And he made Lucky Hand perfume and things like that. And he was an astrologer. So there was a lot of black people who were educated, too. This is not just rural people digging roots out in the South, some sort of plantation tradition. There are educated people who are buying and selling grimoires, medieval grimoires, and, the Seals of Moses. I used to buy these mojo bags that would come with the Seals of Moses, literally, you know, printed on parchment paper, cut out, and stuck into the bag. And also the Seals of Solomon, the Seals of Moses, depending on what the mojo bag was for. Mojo bags being a little red flannel bag where the magical ingredients are kept and prayed over, and the mojo is considered to be alive. It is worked. It is fed. It's a very African type of what anthropologists would call maybe a fetish bag, but there it was with these Jewish seals in it. It's a cultural salad, like I said. It really is a cultural salad.
Well, that's so wonderful. You know, I really I love just hearing you go off on all of this.
I'm sorry,
marvelous lore.
And
go ahead. We only have a minute left, so.
Well, what I would tell you in 1 minute, because I would like to say this. I think that the most important thing about preserving hoodoo into the 21st century is that it is preserving itself. It didn't need me to preserve it, and I would never take the credit for that. I'm here like a mockingbird that listens to the songs of all the birds and plays them back. I was taught this stuff for free. It was given to me by very generous people of all races, primarily black. And I reflect it back the best I can. And I did my best to put it on the web and make it available. That's my purpose here.
Great. Well, thanks so much. And people, again, check out the Lucky Mojo website. Give yourself a couple of hours just to even sort of stumble your way around. And Catherine offers a correspondence course. And check out some of those marvelous things. This is Eric Davis. This is An Expanding Mind. Keep your minds open.